Hello, Gallatin Valley. You're listening to KGVM Bozeman on FM 95.9. This is Dr. Nurse Nancy welcoming you to Body Politic, a program about how our ability to control what we do with our bodies and what happens to our bodies shapes our life experiences. Today's show is about breastfeeding, why breastfeeding rates dropped through much of the 1800s and 1900s, how public health officials and women themselves have worked to increase rates of breastfeeding, and what broad social reforms could support new mothers in feeding their infants in ways that are best for them and for their families. Our first guest today is Dr. Jackie Wolf. She's joining us via Skype from Ohio. She is the author of numerous articles and books, including Don't Kill Your Baby, Public Health and the Decline of Breastfeeding in the 19th and 20th Centuries. Dr. Wolf is a professor of the History of Medicine in the Department of Social Medicine at Ohio University. Dr. Wolf, could you please start by explaining for our listeners what the field of social medicine is all about?
Social medicine is a really multidisciplinary field. In my department, I'm the medical historian. We also have a medical sociologist. We have a political scientist who specializes in health policy. We have two anthropologists, a cultural anthropologist and a biological anthropologist. We have several psychologists. We have an epidemiologist. I hope I'm not missing anybody, but you get the idea. We're social scientists, and we study how culture impacts the practice of medicine, how it shapes medicine, how the healthcare system that we all live in affects medicine. And we argue very strongly that medicine is not a dispassionate science, but it's really something that's shaped by culture. And you can see that clearly by how the same disease can be looked at very differently depending on what country you live in, how your healthcare system works. So that, in a nutshell, is social medicine.
Okay, thank you. So the title of your book about breastfeeding references the decline of breastfeeding in the 19th and 20th centuries. Could you please give us some background on what was going on in the U.S. that caused breastfeeding rates to drop and formula feeding to become the norm by the middle of the 20th century?
Well, the book title that you gave at the beginning of the show really became a book. It was originally my dissertation. It became a book. And when I decided that was going to be my dissertation topic, looking at the history of breastfeeding practices in the U.S., my central research question was, at what point and why did women begin to stop breastfeeding and turn to formula and bottles? And I assumed I would be writing a dissertation about post-World War II America. Mm-hmm. And I assumed that was probably the era when women began to bottle feed in large numbers. And I kept going back in time, and I discovered pretty quickly that it really wasn't post-1945 America. It really was the late 19th century, the last quarter of the 19th century, from roughly 1875 onward, that women began to feed their babies cow's milk.
And why were they doing that? What kinds of, were there economic or social changes that were happening that contributed to this shift?
Social change in that era was huge. That's when the U.S. was urbanizing and industrializing. And what was going on was that women today, when they don't, if they want to breastfeed and don't do it for very long, often the reason they'll give is that they don't have enough milk. That's exactly what was happening in the last quarter of the 19th century, that women started complaining they didn't have enough milk. Doctors were very alarmed, and they thought that it was a physiological problem. They had explanations like human evolution because of industrialization. Human evolution was going in a direction where women wouldn't be able to lactate in a generation or two because of urbanization. Women were becoming, the term was, over-civilized. Another explanation was that women were becoming over-educated. This is my favorite explanation. What they argued was that as girls began spending more time in school, people were alarmed. The argument was that their brains were competing with their growing reproductive organs during puberty, and their brains were winning and their reproductive organs were losing. Therefore, they weren't able to lactate when they became adults. There were books written about that, the over-education of girls. So it was thought to be a medical problem. There was thought to be something wrong with girls' bodies for whatever reason, and they couldn't lactate. Now, what my research showed was that infant feeding advice was changing. In the 16th and 17th, and for much of the 18th, for all of the 18th century, if you look at any advice book about infant care, it all said the same thing. It all said, I mean, I'm speaking now in 17th century lingo, but the exact quote was, feed the baby whenever the baby hath a mind. In other words, when the baby's hungry, feed the baby.
Mm-hmm.
You see that advice changing so much by the late 19th century because of industrialization. Up until that time, Americans did not use the mechanical clock. They got up when the sun rose. They went to bed when the sun set. They got up when the cows mooed because the cows needed milking. And the cows started complaining. They got up when the rooster crowed. But with factories springing up and people beginning for the first time to work outside of their own household, they needed to pay attention to what time it was. Farmers, too, needed to pay attention to when the railroad would be coming into their town, so they would be at the railroad depot at the exact right time, and they wouldn't miss it that day to be able to load their ware on to go from the rural area to the urban consumer. Adults were having a terrible time with this. I mean, we think cultural change is hard now with the internet and with, certainly depending on your generation, we're having a hard time. Think of what it must have been like to go from listening to nature about when you got up and when how you spent your day to having to pay attention to a mechanical clock. Adults were having such a terrible time with it that the theory became if they can train their babies early on, the children and as they grew up, they wouldn't have trouble the way adults were having adjusting to the new attitude toward time. So suddenly infant feeding schedules were very strict, and they all had machine metaphors. Treat the baby like a machine. Make a machine of the baby. You see that in the infant feeding advice constantly. It was all about industrialization, machinery. Teach the baby to have discipline and only feed the baby every X number of hours, or you are going to risk having them be a very irresponsible adult. And there were other very compelling reasons too. Toilet training. The theory was that you could toilet train a baby as early as, I'm going to pause here for effect, 6 weeks of age.
Oh, my goodness.
And if you fed them on a schedule, the theory was you could predict when the baby needed to be held over the chamber pot to eliminate, to poop or to pee. So, again, that was another compelling. Laundry was a terrible ordeal in that era.
You
know,
I bet.
Were no washing machines. You had to haul the water. You had to make the soap. You had to heat up the water. So if you could save on diapers and simply predict when the baby needed to eliminate by putting them on a feeding schedule, there were all kinds of theories like that. Now, what wasn't recognized was the reason women were having lactation failure, which I believe they were. I believe their complaints were right, was because of these strict feeding schedules. I mean, we know anyone who knows a little bit about lactation knows the more a baby sucks on its mother, the more milk the mother is going to produce. So in that era, babies were sucking a lot less on their mother and weren't producing nearly as much milk. So it wasn't a physiological problem, as doctors suspected. It was a cultural problem.
Our guest today is Dr. Jackie Wolf. You are listening to Body Politic on KGVM. Bozeman, FM 95.9. We are talking about breastfeeding rates, why they declined. We'll get to why they rose back. But Dr. Wolf, can you talk about then how infant formula companies, how the formula industry rose and some of the marketing strategies it used?
Well, let me tell you a little bit about the origins of the word formula, because I people absolutely don't know that history. So the history that I was just describing, when women, it looked like they weren't lactating sufficiently, that's when physicians became involved, because babies were becoming very, very sick. The only substitute for human milk was cow's milk. Cow's milk was not as sufficient. It wasn't pasteurized. It took three days to get from rural farmers to urban consumers. There was no refrigeration. Railroad cars were hot. The milk was spoiled. It was a deadly substance. So babies, 13% of babies died before their first birthday in 1900. And more than half of them died of diarrhea. That's how doctors got involved in trying to find a palatable milk substitute, since women were complaining they didn't have enough milk. This is where the word formula was first originated. Formula literally came from mathematical formulas. Pediatricians would write out what we would call now a prescription, but it was a mathematical formula where they would use variables like how old was the baby. That was one, that would be one variable of the formula. And what was the baby's pallor? What was the condition of the baby's stools? Was the baby vomiting? Did the baby have diarrhea? How much did the baby weigh? Each one of those was a variable, and depending on what the mathematical formula looked like, this urban chemist at a milk laboratory would come up with this liquid concoction called a formula, because it was based on mathematical formulas, for that particular baby. Now, that was the origin of the word formula. Your question was about proprietary infant foods, which we now call formula, but they weren't called formula then when it was originated. And those originated, actually, it wasn't intended for babies. It originated during the Civil War when soldiers needed food, needed palatable food. And there was a lot of dysentery, a lot of starvation. A lot of soldiers died not from bullets during the Civil War, but from starvation, from dysentery, from all kinds of gastrointestinal upsets. That's when canned milk was first invented, to give soldiers palatable food. And then that canned milk eventually became available to babies from the kind of proprietary infant food companies that you referred to.
So let's talk about, with the rise of infant formula, how did the companies market their products, and how did that affect breastfeeding rates?
Well, what's very interesting, okay, we have to talk about two time periods here, because the time period I'm talking about, I'm going to try to be historically accurate.
Okay.
Call them proprietary infant food companies, although now, yes, they're called formula companies.
Okay.
They were kind of apologetic about their marketing. I mean, what they essentially said was, always, it would start out, mother's milk is best, but if you are unable to feed your baby, try our formula. It's better than all the others. And then they would describe how babies were starving. They would describe babies being brought on a pillow at the age of 4 months old. They'd only weigh 5 pounds. They'd be emaciated. But if you use Nestle's food, Nestle's food is to be mixed with water, not cow's milk, because cow's milk can spoil. Mixed with water, Nestle's food will save your baby. So it essentially would acknowledge, A, human milk is best, B, other proprietary infant foods are terrible. They would all argue that. But ours, very possibly, will save your baby. So in some ways, they were very apologetic. Now, we think of formula companies now of what they did in the 1950s and 60s and 70s, in which they argued very strongly that because formula was vitamin fortified, iron fortified, that it was actually better than human milk. And there would be... the way we think of as pharmaceutical reps now, this would be formula reps who would go to obstetricians, who would go to pediatricians, who would go to family doctors and knock on their door and peddle formula as being much better than breastfeeding. And I interviewed, as part of my research, I interviewed many doctors who practiced in the 50s and 60s and said, we were swayed by them. And not only that, but formula companies actually sponsored very elaborate trips for doctors where they could bring their wives. They had cruises. They had free trips to the Caribbean. And the only requirement was for physicians to sit and watch a half-hour film about that particular formula company's product. All that is illegal now. Doctors can't accept gifts like that from anyone anymore. But that was the norm then, and doctors began to peddle these formulas for the companies.
And not only in the U.S., right, were companies trying to sell their product, also in developing countries. Talk about that a little bit.
Actually, that came later. After American women began to turn back to breastfeeding, which happened beginning in the early 1970s. We reached our lowest breastfeeding levels in the early 1970s when only 22% of American women initiated breastfeeding in the hospital. And all initiation means is breastfeeding once before hospital discharge. So virtually no one was breastfeeding anymore by the early 1970s in the U.S., very, very few women. As American women began to turn back to breastfeeding, that came with the natural childbirth movement. It came with the environmental movement when we started to talk about environmental toxins, and people began to question industrial America and what it was doing to our bodies and to our environment, and how we treated our infants became part of that conversation. So as American women began to breastfeed more, formula companies began to lose money. So what was their next marketing scheme? They decided to go to developing countries where it was crucial that women breastfed, just as it was crucial back in the 19th century, because we didn't have palatable water back then. We didn't have palatable milk. Same in developing countries. There was no filtered water. There was no chemically treated drinking water. If you mixed formula with water in those countries, babies would get diarrhea because the water wasn't palatable. So it was a horrifying time that formula companies began peddling their wares there. And they did it in the same dishonest way that they did it back in the 1950s and 60s, when they would knock on doctors' doors and say, this is better than human milk. They would have the formula reps dress up in nurses' outfits. They weren't nurses, but they would dress in nurses' outfits to go into hospitals or to wait for women who would come out of hospitals with their new baby. And they would look like nurses, so it would look to women in impoverished areas as though a medical person was recommending formula to them. But formula is very expensive. They'd be given free formula, and they would use it, which would mean their milk would dry up. And by the time their milk dried up, they were stuck with formula. It was very expensive, so the only way they could afford to use it was to water it too much. So between using bad water and watering it too much, babies were dying of both diarrhea and starvation because of the way it was marketed in developing countries.
Our guest today is Dr. Jackie Wolf. We are talking about breastfeeding. We have just a few more minutes. I would love to get into a little bit about what the efforts have been to promote breastfeeding over the last 50 years, since the low in the 1970s.
Well, there have been all kinds of initiatives, and most of them didn't last very long. One of the most recent was started in 2004. It was the National Breastfeeding Awareness Campaign. It was really, I defend the campaign. It was a wonderful campaign. There were television ads, there were print ads, there were wonderful songs written for the radio to promote breastfeeding. It was very imaginative. And the tagline, it was an ad council campaign. The ad council changes American behaviors. Friends, don't let friends drive drunk. Buckle up for safety to get us to use seatbelts are all ad council slogans. So the slogan for the breastfeeding campaign was babies were born to be breastfed. And the question asked was, you wouldn't take risks before your baby's born, why start after? And the ads would talk about, the TV ads were great. There would be a very pregnant woman, visibly pregnant woman, 9 months pregnant on a bucking bronco. Very dangerous activity, and they would say, you wouldn't take risks before your baby's born, why start after? And then they would talk about the risks of formula feeding. Asthma rates are higher, diabetes rates are higher, childhood cancer rates are higher, obesity rates are much higher in formula-fed infants. They would tick them off and to talk about risks, and there was a lot of pushback about how it was making mothers feel guilty, about how it was trying to manipulate mothers. People who were defending the ads said, look, you wouldn't make mothers feel guilty if you talked to them about immunizations. And frankly, formula feeding is adverse to infants' health unless it's medically necessary or unless a woman has to supplement. There are reasons, and it's very hard in our culture to fully breastfeed. I too want to say there are substantial reasons why women formula feed. We are one of only three countries in the entire world that don't give women paid maternity leave. It's very hard to fully breastfeed a baby. You have to be immensely dedicated and educated too in how to pump, which is a whole other story, because that's, you know, one of the hardest parts about breastfeeding now is pumping. Because women don't have maternity leave. So I want to say we don't make it easy for women to breastfeed in this country. There's all kinds of reasons why women must turn to formula.
Dr. Wolf, thank you so much for joining us.
That was Dr. Jackie Wolf. She'll be offering additional comments during the second half hour of this show.
You are listening to Body Politic on KGVM Bozeman 95.9 FM. I'm your host, Dr. Nurse Nancy. Our topic today is breastfeeding. Joining us now is Lynn Hellinger, recently retired registered dietitian and lactation consultant who lives here in Bozeman. Lynn, could you please spend just a couple of minutes telling our listeners what kinds of problems some moms might face? And I'm not talking here about the policy or environmental levels, but on the individual level when they're trying to breastfeed. And how can lactation consultants help?
Sure. First of all, especially for a first-time mom, they don't know what to expect. They've just delivered this baby. Ideally, the baby will be delivered right from their vagina up to their chest, and the baby probably won't even be dried off. They'll have a blanket placed over the baby, and the nurse will take the baby right to the breast and try to get the baby to suckle. And sometimes that works, and sometimes it doesn't. The mom will start to feel a little stinging sensation. Sometimes the mom is offended by that feeling. Sometimes the mom can't tell if the colostrum, which is the first milk, is getting into the baby. There's problems with what is called latch. And latch is when the baby can get a really good suck, swallow, breathe rhythm, where the baby kind of pulls on the nipple and really starts to get the milk duct starting to work. There's a whole process, a physiological process that happens that gets the milk glands starting to work and all of the hormones starting to kick in. And the mom will also start to feel the uterus start to contract. Everything all kind of works together. But if those things aren't working and the baby isn't latching on correctly, and the baby just kind of chews on the nipple, sometimes moms will start off and have cracked nipples. And within a day or two, if that colostrum comes in and the mom isn't able to get that colostrum out of her breast and her real milk or the milk that the baby needs comes in, she will often get engorged. And the milk ducts will, her breasts will get really hard. And she'll have problems with getting any milk out, and then there's issues with that. So lactation consultants are just around to make sure that from the get-go, things are going in the right direction. And a lot of times it's just really, really positive feedback, making sure that the latch is going correctly and everything is moving as positively as it can. And it's really just a lot of positive reinforcement.
That's great to know. I actually, not having had kids and not having tried to breastfeed, I always assumed it was just like this natural, easy thing that everybody did successfully 100% of the time. And it wasn't until I began having friends have babies that I discovered that was not the case. So I'm glad for lactation consultants.
Yeah.
I want to say, you and I know each other professionally. We both worked in public health, and we worked together on a project that, among lots of other things having to do with nutrition and physical activity, was about promoting breastfeeding and making it easier for women to breastfeed and easier for them to be successful at breastfeeding. And I know there were lots of things that we did. You, as the dietitian and the lactation consultant, took the lead on this. The one I'd like to focus in on for this particular interview has to do with the Baby Friendly Hospital Initiative. We're going to be talking more in the second half hour about sort of how that's played out for various women. But could you explain for our listeners what the Baby Friendly Hospital Initiative is all about?
Sure. So the Baby Friendly Hospital Initiative is something that the Center for Disease Control took on as a health initiative, looking at the 2020 initiative goals to try to increase breastfeeding rates. And we're going to talk specifically about the hospital components. There were also community components and worksite components. But within the Baby Friendly Initiative, it is also actually a World Health Organization initiative, and the United States took it on through the Center for Disease Control. But Baby Friendly is really an international initiative, and there are 10 steps or 10 components that healthcare facilities need to follow, first starting with a policy in place, and it is all around environmental and policy changes to make breastfeeding the first choice and the best choice for moms and babies to be promoted throughout for all healthcare providers, and to not promote formula, and to have places for moms that work in the workplace to be able to breastfeed, for moms that have cesarean sections to have support for being, for help with breastfeeding, and a lot of things that hadn't been done in the United States up until the Baby Friendly Initiative became part of the 2020 goals through the Center for Disease Control to work on the Baby Friendly. And in the time from the 2010 when that got added on, I've seen a tremendous change, not only in Montana, but really across the United States for the promoting of breastfeeding. And it's really a wonderful thing to see a lot more healthcare providers, physicians, nurses, a lot more lactation consultants have been trained, and it really has been a very positive, wonderful thing.
So it sounds like you're telling me, and I have no reason to doubt it, I think I've seen evidence that supports this, that the whole pro-breastfeeding movement and the Baby Friendly Initiative has increased breastfeeding rates and has supported breastfeeding. We know, though, that there have been some instances, and I shared some of the literature with you, where people have said, you know, the really rigid adherence to by the letter to the 10 steps can sometimes have negative outcomes. And in the last minute or so that we have, I just wanted to hear from you, now that you've looked at some of those cases, and even though we know that Baby Friendly has been positive in many ways, what would be for you the takeaway message about how to make the situation even better than it is, or better than it is?
Well, I would say that if there's issues with the real rigidity of the policies within Baby Friendly, the idea is that the baby is fed the best possible way given the clinical situation of the mom and baby at that time. And it really needs to be decided between the mom and the physician and what's clinically necessary. And sometimes there are missed opportunities and sometimes there are human error, but people really need to be aware of physiologically what is really going on with that baby and what that specific baby needs at that time.
So it sounds like care providers need to really pay attention and be willing to be not so rigid, have the flexibility to assess the situation, address the mom and baby's needs, and go with that.
Yes.
Thank you.
Looking at weight loss and diaper changes, just those really basic things.
Thank you so much, Lynn Hellinger.